a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Governor Dennis Stuttgart.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us for this Friday morning news conference. This is the end of the second week of the legislative session, and I'm pleased with the progress of the session thus far. The Public Safety Improvement Act, which is, of course, the centerpiece of the issues about which I'm concerned, or about which I had proposals, is before the Senate State Affairs Committee at this very moment. And I know that we have a large number of folks offering positive testimony on the bill, and to the extent that there's opposition, I hope that any questions will be answered and any concerns will be addressed. But I'm optimistic about the prospects for the Public Safety Improvement Act and hope that it becomes law. I'm also hopeful about the tourism tax bill. Yesterday it passed the House Taxation Committee on a 14-1 vote. In the wake of the very positive tourism news and the positive numbers that we were able to report yesterday, I'm hopeful that people will see that the marketing dollars that those tax revenues support have been effective in helping the South Dakota economy. And that will be on the House floor today, and House leadership tells me they expect to take it up and act today. So we'll see, and I'm hopeful that does occur. There's been much in the media about gun legislation and school safety lately, so I wanted to talk a little bit about that. I know there's some interest in that. I have three things I want to say about that. First, I'll be surprised if Congress passes gun control legislation this year. We have a highly divided Congress. There's, of course, a Republican control of the House, and many of those representatives would oppose some of the measures that President Obama has offered. Also, even in the Democrat-controlled Senate, there are a number of Democrat senators that I think may not support that. The Hill Capital News magazine or newspaper reported yesterday there's a number of Senate Democrats who are balking at President Obama's gun control measures. And so whether or not those bills get out of one house or another, I think it's very unlikely that Congress will pass anything of substance. I also believe South Dakota's gun laws are pretty good right now. I think we strike a balance that allows our citizens to enjoy their heritage of hunting and the outdoors and shooting. I think they also have the right by using our concealed carry law to gain reciprocity in other states. And I think we want to continue to protect their ability to gain that immediate reciprocity in other states. And I think our laws provide that balance and that that right. Thirdly, if we want to improve school safety, I think we should remember that not all schools are the same. We have some schools in South Dakota that are in very rural environments. We have other schools that are in larger metropolitan environments. I think in every case where school safety is addressed, should take place through consultation with law enforcement and consultation with school leaders. Toward that end, within a week after the Connecticut shooting, I directed our Homeland Security and Department of Public Safety to reach out to our public schools and our schools, all of our schools across the state, and offer their assistance toward evaluating school security and school safety improvement. I know our Director of Homeland Security, J.C. Carpenter, has met with at least one Watertown area group of school superintendents, and I know he has plans to conduct more meetings. I myself met with the police chiefs on Wednesday and asked their input on school safety. And just this morning, we had a teleconference with sheriffs around the state. The Department of Public Safety coordinated a teleconference to gain their input, and I know they are planning a Tuesday teleconference with school superintendents in addition. I think some of the input that I've gained or some of the thinking that I've heard from those who, from law enforcement, who've offered their attitudes include suggestions to harden school entry points, make sure that there's single points of entry and that those points are as secure as they can be. They emphasize the importance of drills, that practice makes perfect, as they say, and to the extent that schools are very good at practicing for fires, they should also be very good at practicing for other kinds of threats, and that law enforcement should be involved, and they likewise should be drilling. And they also made the comment that training is important, both at the school level and at the law enforcement level, and the kind of training that one should utilize, the most effective kind, is frequent, repetitive, and of short duration. It's not an 8-hour day worth of training once a year. It's more frequent, it's more repetitive, and it's not as lengthy, and it involves action and activity. Those are the things that they offered as ideas, and I'm sure there'll be many more ideas toward improving school safety. And with that, I'd open up for any questions that you may have.
Governor.
You mentioned the state's concealed carry law. You said it's pretty good now. Does that mean you'd resist any effort to change that and get away with the requirement that people need a permit?
I think last year there was some legislation that changed the law to allow concealed carry without a permit. And one of the concerns I expressed last year was that while that may be fine in South Dakota, it also would present a problem for those citizens who would think if they're legal in South Dakota, they would probably be legal elsewhere, and they'd enter into some other neighboring states that have concealed carry permit requirements, and that the current concealed carry permit that South Dakota provides gets them that reciprocity and keeps them legal in those other states. And so I'd have that same concern about a resurrection of the idea of concealed carry without a permit. I think our citizens have the right to carry under the Second Amendment. I just don't want them to have to be surprised in other states when they didn't realize they might get in trouble.
Governor, on the subject of school safety and guns, you talked about one of the highest profile pieces of legislation recently filed is the so-called School Sentinels Bill, which would give local schools the option of arming employees or people in the building. And I was wondering what you thought about that, if that's you think that's a good approach, or that's something you have concerns about, or where you feel.
Yeah, I just heard about that bill this morning. I have not read the bill. Has it been filed? Do you know? It has been filed. I have not had a chance to read the bill. I guess those of you who were here when I was in the legislature will remember I am very determined not to express opinion on a bill until I've heard both sides on the matter, and certainly not before I've read it. So I'll reserve my answer until after I've read the bill. And I'd also want to hear from law enforcement and school officials about that bill. To the extent that it addresses school safety, again, I think we need to be attentive to some of those things I mentioned earlier. We need to talk with law enforcement. We need to talk with local school officials and be sure that their on-the-ground involvement is part of it and that they have their reaction to it. And that would inform my attitude about it, certainly.
Do we have any questions from people who are on the phone? If so, press #6 to unmute and *6 immediately after asking your question.
Governor, I'd like to ask, if I can, about the Public Safety Improvement Act.
Yes.
I've been speaking with some of the lawmakers from Indian Country in South Dakota, the Native folks who express a lot of support for this act and say they've been brought to the table and been a part of the whole discussion. What did you do specifically to include tribes and Native folks in the framing of this act, and why did you see that as important?
The question was, what did we do to include Native American or Indian Country folks in the development of the Public Safety Improvement Act, and why is that important? I don't know that we targeted specific Native groups so much as we targeted anyone who is involved in the criminal justice system. So that would include the judiciary on the reservations. It would include law enforcement on the reservations, because one of the problems that we have in implementing a good, seamless criminal justice system is jurisdictional issues. And I think it's also a commonly held misunderstanding that if you look at a roadmap and you cross over a line that's shown on the map as being the beginning of the Oglala Lakota Reservation or the Rosebud Reservation,
I'll get to it when I get to it,
that there are no other properties that may be considered Indian country, and that's not so. There's Indian country land in Tripp County. There's Indian country land in the north half of Nalet County. And we do have frequent jurisdictional issues where we're unsure what law enforcement. Someone on the line has their phone open. If you press, what is it, pound mute or pound six?
I think we're going to remute the phones just to make sure that those who joined us late and maybe were not muted when they got into the system are muted at this point. So let me remute the phones. Just hold on, please.
Okay, thanks.
Just a second, Governor.
The leader has unmuted your line. The leader has muted your line. To unmute your line, press pound six.
Thanks for your patience. I think it's important because it's important to engage tribal governments and tribal law enforcement in this issue because we have those cross-jurisdictional issues. In some cases, too, we have absconders from probation or parole who are just going home for the weekend or who want to go home for the weekend. And if our relationship with that government isn't solid, or if there's some concern that the individual rights of the person who in our system has absconded but maybe from their vantage point has escaped an unfair system, then that's problematic for us. So we need to engage all parties who have a part to play in the law enforcement system. And one of the pieces of the Public Safety Improvement Act that I'm hopeful will be adopted and is part of the package is a provision for at least one, or maybe two pilots on reservations where someone who, say, from Rapid City that was convicted of an offense there that's either on probation or have served their time and is now on parole could be supervised in Rapid City or supervised, say, at Rosebud or at Oglala Lakota Reservation, and there'd be communication between those supervising folks, whether they be on reservation or off, and we'd still have the same swift and sure sanctions for violating conditions of probation or parole. We'd still have the same rewards for compliance with the probation or parole, and so we want the system to work the same whether you're on the reservation or off.
And if I can ask on that same topic, I haven't been able to monitor what's going on with Senate Bill 70 right now, I think, on this. But it sounds like there is going to be an amendment to change the issue of preliminary hearings. And I want to get your opinion if you think that this would be a friendly amendment, if this is something you would still support if it was passed.
The question was, what about an amendment to the Public Safety Improvement Act that eliminated the section that dispenses with preliminary hearings, automatic preliminary hearings? Right now, South Dakota is only one of seven states in the nation that provides a statutory right to have a preliminary hearing. What that means is that we're going to have law enforcement, judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, victims, and offenders all involved in a preliminary hearing. When you look at how that is working in application, last year we had 22,000 Class 1 misdemeanors. There is no preliminary hearing right for Class 2 right now, and there is only the right in the case of Class 1 misdemeanors and felonies. And the provision in the Public Safety Improvement Act would eliminate the statutory right to a preliminary hearing for Class 1 misdemeanors. As I said, we had 22,000. Less than 1% of those had their case dismissed after a preliminary hearing because of lack of probable cause. For all the others that had a preliminary hearing, it was essentially wasted time by the judges, by the prosecutors, by the defense attorneys, the victims. And that time could be more effectively spent on other aspects of the judgment of the criminal justice system while still protecting that less than 1%. They can still get a probable cause hearing. They'll still, but not through the means of a preliminary hearing, an automatic, scheduled, systematized appearance before the judge. Most of those are routine and wasted. And so as we ask our judges and prosecutors and defense attorneys and law enforcement to use their time more effectively in supervision over people who are in the community and dealing with law enforcement real needs, we need to get rid of wasted bureaucracy at the same time. And so we would resist any amendment that would change that aspect of the package, because we think it's an important means of saving a lot of time and expense that's wasted right now.
Do we have any questions from those on the line? Again, #6 to unmute, *6 to remute your phone.
Governor?
Yes.
Tony Mangan from KCCR Radio. Regarding the school resource, some of the bills about school security, there's been some talk about maybe adding more officers in or having more officers in the schools. Is that something you would support or be in favor of?
Well, certainly, anytime you have a law enforcement officer in any environment, that environment is safer. So to say one would oppose that, of course, it makes no sense. At the same time, we have to marshal what resources we have and utilize them in the most appropriate way that we can. I think it's up to local school districts, up to local law enforcement agencies, up to governments at all level where they spend their resources. Again, there's lots of needs out there. There's lots of wishes for action. I think I'd like to talk to school districts and law enforcement and see if there's a question about should it be a mandate from the state. That's one thing. If it's an authorization or an allowance by the state for local decision-making, that's another thing. If it requires dollars, that's still another thing. So the concept of school resource officers is something I support. We've had school resource officers in my children's school when they were in school, and it's a good thing. In talking to the sheriffs this morning, they said, at least one of them said, those tend to be one-third counselors and two-thirds law enforcement officers. And that's not necessarily bad either. You develop relationship with the kids. You understand and know who the kids are that are behaving one way or behaving another. So it would be a good thing if we can afford to do it. It really depends on a school-by-school analysis and whether it makes sense.
What is your impression, Governor, as you travel the state and you're in public buildings, Capitol or any school or whatever, do you sense that most public buildings in South Dakota are safe?
I think South Dakota is a very safe state in which to live. I think anytime you have public gathering areas, they could become a target. I haven't seen that occur to any great degree in South Dakota as yet.
Can I ask about the whole issue of gun control? There's a mental health aspect to the debate. What role do you see as, I guess, positive mental health or mental health issues playing in this debate? Does this need to be part of gun control in some way, or do we need a more robust system? Or
Where does mental health come into play in this debate about gun legislation and school safety? I'll frame it that way. I really think that we are addressing that not as a consequence of the Connecticut school shooting, but as a consequence of our study of the criminal justice system in South Dakota. If you look at the ongoing funding that we're proposing, most of that ongoing funding is to deal with treatment, to provide funding for treatment, which could be addictive treatment or mental health issues. And so to the extent that folks in society find their way into the system, rather than our system just locking them up and not dealing with the underlying problem, which could then manifest itself in a much more violent act, we're trying to change our system so we provide better treatment options. And I think that's a response that's really a more global response than just prompted by a tragic event.
Governor, switching subjects to Medicaid, you've been public in your skepticism about expanding Medicaid, at least this year, saying that you have concerns about that, you have questions that haven't been answered. And I was wondering if you could explain a little bit more about the nature of your opposition and your skepticism there, whether this is something that you would advise the legislature not to do, or something that you're firmly opposed to do and would try to block the legislature from doing if there is a will among that body to try to expand Medicaid despite your concerns.
Well, I do not believe we should expand Medicaid this year. It's founded on a couple of different things, a couple different points. One point is financial. I think you all know, because of the state of the state and my budget messages in recent years, that I'm very concerned about the federal government's spending. We're spending, last year again, I'll recite it, $3.5 billion, and we only brought in, or trillion rather, and we only brought in $2.4 trillion. So we're spending about 40% more than we're taking in. And here is a program where the federal government is promising to add to that spending level. We can't afford the spending we're making right now. And yet the federal government is saying, let's all you states expand and we'll cover it all. And then we'll drop that coverage down to about 90% over the next 7 or 8 years, or 6 years really. But then we'll hold it at 90%. I just am very skeptical that the federal government can or should be making promises like that when they are fiscally out of control and politically unable to get control of themselves, whether through more revenue or through less spending. The federal government can't get control of itself, from what I can see. Well, now we'll see in March what happens when they deal with the debt ceiling, when they deal with the continuing resolution. They haven't adopted a budget in several years. I mean, by all indications, the federal budget is absolutely done by the seat of the pants, day after day. So I really am disappointed in that. So as a consequence, I'm very skeptical that the federal government will be able to keep its promises to maintain the level of funding that they promised to maintain. Secondly, more philosophically, I wonder about the increasing march toward dependence of our citizens. We have many safety net programs that I fully support, but those safety net programs are expanded from time to time. When in 2007 on food stamps, we had about 80,000 people. Now we have about 110,000 people in just 5 going on 6 years now. And that dependence on food stamps has not come down, even though by most measures, we have nearly recovered from the recession. And why is that? Because A, people become more dependent, and B, the eligibility has been expanded. So suddenly we have 1 in 8 people in South Dakota that supposedly can't provide for their own food. And now we want to decide that about 160,000 people out of our 800 can't provide for health insurance. I think it's worth waiting at least a year. In 2014, we will have about 22,000 out of the 48,000 expansion population that would come on if we expanded Medicaid. We'll add 48,000. Of those 48,000, about 22,000, by our estimates, would be eligible for subsidies in 2014. And so if they're going to get a tax subsidy at that time, wouldn't it make sense to see if some of those could carry their own weight, at least part of their own weight, contribute something, if not, instead of nothing? I think we all appreciate that which we have some participation in paying for, and when you've done nothing to earn something, you appreciate it less and don't take care of it as well. So I think it's also philosophical beyond the dollar issue. I'm interested in continuing the conversation. I don't mean at all to suggest I'm my feet are in concrete. I want to understand more. I've asked the Department of Social Services to try and dig back into the data and tell me more about those 22,000 people and the balance of the 26,000 that wouldn't be eligible for subsidy. I also asked Secretary Sebelius just this week in a phone conversation to Washington, would you reconsider your position that it's an all or nothing? Couldn't we be allowed to expand, say, those up to 100% of the poverty level instead of all the way up to 138 and let the 100 to 138 see how they do on the subsidy? And she said no. And that's the president's decision as well. So I think the discussion is still ongoing, and I'm still learning. I think a lot of us are still learning. And so I think it's an important discussion to continue. But right now, I still believe that we should not expand in 2014. And I'll be interested in continue that conversation, though.
Governor Brewer in Arizona recently came out with a qualified endorsement of expansion and said that she would support adding a trigger mechanism to that, which is to say that if, as you've said, you're afraid of the subsidies drop below what's been promised, the expansion would cancel itself. And I heard from the Republican leaders earlier today that that's a clause that interests a lot of people in their caucuses. I was wondering what your thoughts were on possibly a trigger mechanism being a way to make to solve some of these concerns that people have about the fiscal side of expanding Medicaid.
You know, it is an interesting approach. The one thing I'd be concerned about is I would not be interested in considering that approach unless I felt that there was some fair likelihood that the federal government could keep its commitment to maintain its share, because otherwise we create a system where a lot of people become reliant and dependent on the expanded population only to pull the rug out from under them in just a few short years. And we don't want to be kangarooing around in a situation like that. So it's an interesting approach. I think it's also noteworthy that Arizona, I'm told, is implementing a provider tax to cover some of the expense of that. And I know that has been tried and failed in South Dakota more than once. So there's more to the Arizona approach than just the trigger clause or fail-safe clause. And I do think it's also important to do something that we believe is sustainable and not just say, well, let's try it, and then when you get reliant and used to it, then we might just pull the rug out.
I spoke with Representative Kevin Killer earlier this week, and he said he wants to examine the idea of getting tribes to start their own insurance exchanges underneath the Affordable Care Act. And also he says that there are provisions within the Affordable Care Act that are specifically directed at tribes, especially if state and tribes work together to help tribal members get onto those Medicare rolls. I wanted to get your response to those ideas, if that's something that the state could work and do, or if you see if that is, does that fit within the Act? Is that part of tribal sovereignty here?
I can't see how that would be workable, given that South Dakota's study determined that with our small population statewide, we don't have enough to make it very efficient to try and create a health insurance exchange system with a still smaller population. Seems to me would even exacerbate that difficulty.
Governor, if I can go back to your fairly strong views on the federal government and its handling of the budget. And I wonder if you have any comments in light of the collegial atmosphere at the beginning of this session between the party leadership and the executive branch. And are there lessons from this state that can be applied? And do you think that might be something that's worthwhile to put some set some examples and put some pressure upward?
Well, I think one thing that makes a difference in South Dakota is, I mentioned this last week, in fact, when someone asked a question about the collegial atmosphere here in Pierre, and one of the comments I made, well, you have to remember, about a third of the legislature is brand new, so they don't have any enmity that's born of past unhappy interactions with someone who voted against their bill or spoke strongly and passionately against their legislation. And in Congress, you don't have that kind of turnover. There are no term limits. And so you have people who have built up a dislike and enmity toward another member of the Congress over a period of years. So that might be something. I guess that's just off the top of my head. I do think it's important, and I try to stress that to myself in my self-talk. You can disagree with someone without getting personal, without attacking. I'm not perfect. I fail too many times in that. And get mad at someone or angry at someone for believing differently than I do. And yet, at the end of the day, I know I'm wrong when I do that. If I can keep control of myself and treat people respectfully and stay on the points and not on the person, that helps us reach better conclusions, I think. And results that are in the end better for our citizens. There are differences in Congress too that cause them to be less effective. In South Dakota, every bill that's introduced gets a hearing. That's not true in Congress. Every bill that gets a hearing in committee can be called by a relative minority to the floor for a vote. That's not the way it works in Congress. So I think there are procedural approaches in South Dakota that create, in my mind, a fairer system. Now, that's a naive view in some ways, because I don't pretend to be an expert on procedure in the U.S. Senate or in the U.S. House. But I do know that, again, they allow policy decisions to be part of appropriations, and we don't allow that. So you get appropriations that are very important financially for the country, but they get loaded down with a very divisive policy amendment that changes the dynamic when a member is making a decision about a vote. Yes, we need this financial bill, but I don't like that policy. In South Dakota, you can't do that. the policy bill has to stand on its own. The appropriation can be only an appropriation. So there are some differences, but again, I'm not an expert on congressional procedures, and so that might be an unfair characterization. I don't think so, but it might be.
We should be wrapping this up. Do we have any other questions, perhaps from those on the phone? Again, it's #6 to unmute and *6 to remute. Anything? If not, call to close.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.